This was the beginning of the present large and rich monastery. Many years later, when Tsongkhapa had already begun his reformation work, his mother, from whom he had been separated for a long time, wished to see him again and sent him a letter to call him back. At that time, Tsongkhapa lived in central Tibet. During a mystic meditation, he understood that his journey to Amdo would benefit nobody, and therefore he only wrote to his mother. With his letter he gave to the messenger two pictures of himself intended for his mother and his sister, a picture of Jayalwasenge, Lord of Science and Eloquence, the patron of the intellectuals, and several pictures of Demchog, a deity of the Tantric pantheon. When these objects were being handed to the family of the reformer, the latter, exercising his magic powers from afar, caused the picture of the deities to appear on the leaves of the miraculous tree. The print was so neat, so perfect, according to the legend, that the most clever artist could not have drawn them better. With the pictures, various other marks and the six writings, the formula in six syllables, or Mani Padmham, appeared on the branches and the bark of the tree. This is the origin of the name Kambam, 100,000 images, by which the monastery became known. In the account of their journey in Tibet, the French fathers Huc and Gaibet affirm that they have read the words Om Mani Padme Hum on the leaves and the trunk of the tree. Now, what kind of tree did these two travelers see? The monastery's chronicles relate that after the miraculous appearance of the images on the tree, the latter was wrapped in a piece of silk, a robe, and that a temple was built around it. Was it an unroofed one? The word courtman used in the text does not favor that opinion, for a courtman is a monument with a needle-like top and consequently closed. The chronicles mention also that the miraculous tree remained unchanged in winter and summer, and that the number of its leaves was always the same. We read again that, once upon a time, noises were heard inside the courtman in which the tree stood. The abbot of Kambam entered it, cleaned the space around the tree, and found near to it a small quantity of liquid which he drank. These details seem to indicate that the tree was in a closed room but seldom entered, while the wonder of keeping its leaves during the winter 79. The species to which belongs the Kambam tree has caducous leaves. Tulcus occupy a prominent place in Lamaism. They constitute one of its most striking features, which set it quite apart from all other Buddhist sects. It is difficult to find one's way amongst these conflicting accounts. Today a courtin about 40 to 50 feet high dot in which the original tree is said to be enshrined 80 stands in the middle of a gold-roofed temple. Yet, when I lived in Kambam, the lamas said that the shrine had been erected only a few years ago. Or rather rebuilt after a fire which destroyed it. In front of that temple grows a shoot of the miraculous tree, surrounded by a railing, and is venerated to a certain extent. Another larger tree, which is also believed to have originated from the miraculous tree, has been transplanted into a small garden before the temple of the Buddha. The leaves of these two trees are collected when they fall, and distributed to the devotees. Perhaps it is one of these two which the fathers Huc and Gaibet saw. Foreign travelers who go to Kambam, as a rule, do not know the history, or even the existence, of the tree hidden in the shrine. Some Europeans residing in Kansu. The Chinese province on the border of which Kambam is situated have told to me that they have read Om Mani Padme Hum on the leaves of the living trees. However, Lamaist pilgrims and the monks of the monastery, about 3,000 men, do not notice anything peculiar about these leaves and even listen with scornful skepticism to accounts of the foreigners' visions of the sacred trees. Nevertheless, their modern attitude is not supported by the old chronicles, which affirm that all people of Amdo saw the miraculous imprints on the tree when they first appeared, about 400 years ago. Living Buddha. Besides the various officials, there exist, in the Gompas, another class of men who, as a rule, do not take any direct part in the business of the monastery and live more or less aloof in their sumptuous mansions. These are the Lamas Tulkas. The real character of the Lamas Tulkas has never been correctly defined by Western authors, and it would almost seem that they have never even suspected it. However, the theories regarding Tulkas are well worth our attention, for they are far removed from any belief in incarnations or transmigrating spiritual entities and, as we will see, border upon the field of psychic phenomena. The peculiar religious aristocracy which goes by the name of Tulkas is not of very ancient origin. It is only after AD 1650 that it developed in the form which exists at present. The fifth Grand Lama of the Gelugpa sect, Yellow Caps, Lobsang Gyatso by name, had then been newly enthroned as temporal ruler of Tibet by a Mongolian prince and recognized as such by the Chinese emperor. Yet, these earthly honors failed to satisfy the ambitious Lama, and he added to them by declaring himself to be an emanation of the Bodhisattva Chen Rezigs. At the same time, he established his religious teacher as Grand Lama of Tashilhunpo, affirming that he was a Tulku of Odpagmd, a mystic Buddha of whom Chen Rezigs is the spiritual son. Chen Rezigs and Odpagmd are, respectively, the Tibetan names of the mystic beings called in Sanskrit Avalokiteshvara and Amitabha. The example set by the Lama king encouraged the creation of Tulkas. Very soon, all monasteries of some importance deemed it a point of honor to have, at their head, an incarnation of one or another worthy. However, in setting himself up as a Tulku of Chen Rezigs, Lobsang Gyatso had not been entirely an innovator. Theories affording him some support can be traced in the Mahayanist speculations regarding the mystic Buddhas and their spiritual family of bodhisattvas and human Buddhas who are said to emanate from them. Moreover, since the death, about AD 1470, of Jijamdub, the disciple of the reformer Tsongkhapa, his successors as head of the Yellow Caps sect had been recognized as his reincarnations. So, the fifth Dalai Lama was therefore already a Tulku of Jijamdub when he became Chen Rezig S84. Chen Rezig, Tib, Bodhisattva of Compassion Tulku. But even earlier, in the 11th century, Tibetans believed in Tulkas. We read in the biography of Mylarspa, that one of his disciples, called Bhaira, convinced that a divine being was incarnated in his master, asked him to disclose his name. Mylarspa himself believed that his own master, the Lama Mapa, was the Tulku of Dorji Chang. He called him by that name repeatedly, not only in his poems, but when addressing him directly. So, though recognized avatars were, at first, insulated cases and not in the regular lineal succession of incarnations, they have paved the way for the Dalai Lama Chen Rezigs and the thousands of lordly Tulkas who are nowadays to be found all over the Lamaist countries. Living Buddha is a current appellation given by foreigners to Lamas Tulkas. Now, in spite of the many books on Buddhism which have been published in Western languages, there still remain a large number of Westerners who take the word Buddha for a proper noun, the name of the founder of Buddhism. To these people, the words living Buddha convey the idea of a reincarnation of Gautama the historical Buddha. There is no Tibetan, even amongst the most ignorant, villagers or herdsmen, who entertains such a false view. As for learned lamas, they agree with all other Buddhists, in declaring that the Buddha Gautama 85.Sakyathubbu as he is called in Tibet. There exist also nuns who are Tulkas of departed saintly ladies or goddesses. 85 cannot be incarnated again. The reason of it is that Gautama has entered Nirvana, a state which precludes all possibilities of reincarnation, for that which is called Nirvana is precisely a setting free from the round of births and death. So much for avatars of the historical Buddha. There have never been any in the past and none exist at present. Can there be incarnations of other Buddhas? In fact, no. And for the same reason, the Buddhas have entered Nirvana. It is, indeed, because they have realized that condition that they are Buddhas. However, while in southern Buddhist countries the title of Buddha is exclusively given to the historical human Buddha, to his supposed predecessors and to his expected successor, Maitreya, northern Buddhists have imagined a number of symbolic and mystic entities, certain of which are styled Buddha. It is these who are said to manifest themselves through avatars, and their avatars may assume other forms than that of human being. It follows that, according to popular belief, a Tulkas is either the reincarnation of a saintly or peculiarly learned departed personality, or the incarnation of a non-human entity. The number of the former greatly exceeds that of the latter. Tulkas of non-human entities are limited to a few avatars of mystic Buddhas, bodhisattvas or deities, such as the Dalai Lama, the Grand Lama of Tashilunpo, the Lady Dorfagmo and, lower in rank, the Tulkas of some autochthonous gods like Paka, Tulkas of gods, demons and fairies. 86. Kadham is amongst the exceptions. I may mention the father and mother of the reformer Tsongkhapa. Both reincarnate in male children who become monks and as lamas, have their seat at Kambum Monastery. The lama who is held to be the reincarnation of Tsongkhapa's father is called Agyatsang and is the lord of the monastery. When I lived at Kambum, he was a boy in his 10th year. 86 appear especially as heroes of stories, yet some living men and women enjoy, as such, some local renown. This category of Tulkas is not reckoned amongst the Lamaist aristocracy. One may think that it originated not in Lamaism, but in the old religion of Tibet. Though Buddhism denies the existence of a transmigrating soul and considers the belief in a permanent ego as almost pernicious error, the large majority of unlearned Buddhists have lapsed into the old Indian doctrine, which represents the periodically changing his worn-out body for a new one, as we cast away worn-out garments to clothe ourselves in a new. 88. Bhagavad Gita, 2.22. When the Tulku is considered as the incarnation of a god or the emanation of a spiritual entity who coexists with him, the reason afforded by the self changing his flesh garment does not explain his nature. But average Tibetans do not think deeply, and for all practical purposes Tulkas of celestial personages are considered as true reincarnations of their predecessors. Have been recognized? These are styled rosary of births or rosary of bodies. By the by, I may say that it is a cause of amusement for the observer to remark how intelligence and holiness often seem to become exhausted in a succession of incarnations. It is not unusual to find an utterly stupid fellow as the supposed embodiment of some eminent thinker, or to see an earthly-minded epicure recognized as the incarnation of a mystic anchorite famous for his austerity. The reincarnation of the Tulkas cannot astonish people who believe in a transmigrating ego. According to that view, we all are Tulkas, for the self, now embodied in our present form, cannot but have existed previously in other forms. The only peculiarity with Tulkas is that they are reincarnations of remarkable personalities, that they, sometimes, remember their previous lives and are able, at the time of death, to choose and make known the place of their next birth and their future parents. However, some lamas see a complete difference between the process of reincarnation in the case of common men and that of the enlightened ones. Men, they say, who have practiced no mental training, who live like animals, yielding thoughtlessly to their impulses, are like travelers who wander over the world without any fixed purpose. Such a man sees a lake in the east, and, being thirsty, hurries away to the water. When nearing the shore, he perceives the smell of smoke. This suggests the presence of a house or a camp. It would be pleasant, he thinks, to get hot tea instead of water, and a shelter for the night. So the man leaves the lake without having actually reached its shore and proceeds to the north, the smoke coming from that direction. On his way, before he has yet discovered any houses or tent, threatening phantoms spring up before him. Terrified, the wanderer turns away from the fearful beings and runs for life towards the south. When he deems that he has gone far enough to be safe, he stops to rest. Now, other wanderers pass who tell him of some blissful land of joy and plenty that they intend to reach. Full of enthusiasm, the vagrant joins the party and goes off to the west. And on the road he will be tempted many times to change his direction again before seeing the enchanted country. So continually roaming at random all his life, that simpleton will reach no goal whatever. Death will overtake him on the road, and the conflicting forces of his disordinated activity will be scattered to the four winds. The coordinated amount of energy 92. In Tibetan Tsalor Shugs, 92 necessary to determine the continuation of a same current of force not having been produced, no Tulkas can arise. On the contrary, the enlightened one is likened to a traveler well aware of the goal which he means to reach, well informed, also, of its geographical position and the roads that lead to it. The mind unflinchingly fixed on his aim, indifferent to the various mirages and allurements of the roadside, this man controls the forces begotten by his concentration of mind and his bodily activity. Death may dissolve his body on the path, but the psychic energy of which that body is both creator and instrument, will remain coherent. Pushing forward towards the same goal, it will provide itself with a new material instrument, that is to say with a new form which is a tulku. Here we meet with different views. Some lamas think that the subsisting subtle energy attracts elements of congenial essence and thus becomes the nucleus of a new being. Others say that the disembodied force joins an already existing being, whose material and mental dispositions, acquired in previous lives, provide a harmonious union. Needless to say that several criticisms and objections may be brought forward against these theories, but the present book is meant only to relate Lamaist opinions and not to discuss them. I can only say that all the views I have mentioned are consistent with a number of old Tibetan stories whose heroes determine, by an act of will, 93. According to Lamaists, that will is determined, depends on causes. 93. The nature of their rebirth and the course of action of their future avatar. This shows that similar theories have been widely spread among Tibetans for a long time. In spite of the part which a conscious purpose plays in bringing about the continuation of a line of tulkus, one must beware of thinking that the composition of the new personality is arbitrarily produced. The determinist idea is too strongly rooted in the mind even of the wildest Tibetan herdsman to allow of such an idea. Laws are said to be at work during the whole process which proceeds according to natural attractions and repulsions. More learned Lamaists hold another view regarding the nature of tulkus. This is, in fact, the only truly orthodox one, which fully agrees with the very meaning of the term tulku. The word tulku means a form created by magic, and in accordance with that definition, we must consider the tulkus as phantom bodies, occult emanations, puppets constructed by a magician to serve his purpose. I cannot do better than quote, here, the explanation of tulkus given to me by the Dalai Lama as I have related it in the first chapter of the present book. I met the Dalai Lama in 1912 when he was living in the Himalayas, and asked him several questions regarding Lamaist doctrine, to which he first answered orally. Afterward, in order to avoid misunderstandings, he told me to write a list of new questions on the points which still appeared to me obscure. To these he gave written answers. The present quotation is taken from the document with which the Dalai Lama favored me. It happens, not unfrequently, that a Lama, often himself one of a line of tulkus, foretells, at his deathbed, the country or district where he will be reborn. Sometimes he adds various particulars about his future parents, the situation of their house and so on. 94. Of himself in thousands, millions of worlds. He may create not only human forms, but any forms he chooses, even those of inanimated objects such as hills, enclosures, houses, forests, roads, bridges, etc. He may produce atmospheric phenomena as well as the thirst-quenching beverage of immortality. 95. The latter expression I have been advised to take in both a literal and a symbolic sense. In spite of the various more or less subtle theories held about tulkus in learned Tibetan circles, they are considered, for all practical purposes, as real reincarnations of their predecessors, and the formalities regarding their recognition have been devised accordingly. 95. In fact, reads the conclusion, there is no limit to his power of phantom creation. The theory sanctioned in these lines by the highest authority of official Lamaism is identical with that expounded in the Mahayanist literature, where it is said that an accomplished bodhisattva is capable of effecting 10 kinds of magic creations. The power of producing magic formations, tulkus or less lasting and materialized tulpas, does not, however, belong exclusively to such mystic exalted beings. Any human, demoniac being may be possessed of it. The only difference comes from the degree of power, and this depends on the strength of the concentration and the quality of the mind itself. The talkas of mystic entities coexist with their spiritual parent. For instance, while the Dalai Lama, who is Chenrezig's talku, lives at Lhasa, Chenrezig himself, so Tibetans believe, dwells in Nangkhypotla, an island near the Chinese coast. 96. Putashang Island in the Chao Shan Archipelago, off the coast of Chekiang. So, also, in contradiction with the orthodox tradition which tells that the historical Buddha Gautama is the incarnation of a bodhisattva who came down from the Tushi to heaven, some Buddhists have affirmed that he who is the real Buddha was never incarnate, but that he created a phantom which appeared in India as Gautama 99. The Buddhist sect which held that view was that of the Vetulaka. A number of objects such as rosaries, ritualistic implements, books, teacups. 102. Each Tibetan owns a private bowl in which he alone drinks tea. That bowl may be the wooden one of the poor or the costly jade one with golden saucer and cover of the rich, or any of the intermediate kinds, but it is never lent to anyone to drink in. 102, etc., are placed together, and the child must pick out those which belonged to the late talku, thus showing that he recognizes the things which were his in his previous life. 99. 96. The Dhyani Buddha on Pagmed, of whom the Tashi, Pongchen, Lama is the talku, resides in the western paradise, Nubduachn. Men, also, may coexist with their magic progeny. King Srungbstan Gampo and the warrior chieftain Jizer of Ling are illustrations of this. In our own days it is said that when he fled from Shigatse, the Tashi Lama left, in his stead, a phantom perfectly resembling him who played his part so thoroughly and naturally that everyone who saw him was deceived. When the Lama was safe beyond the border, the phantom vanished. 97. See the account of the Tashi Lama flight in my book, My Journey to Lhasa. 97. The three men here mentioned are themselves talkas, but according to Lamaists, that circumstance does not preclude the further creation of emanations. These spring from one another and there exist denominations for emanations of the second or the third degree. 98. Yang talku emanated from a talku, Xam talku emanated from the talku of a talku. 98. It may happen that the selfsame defunct lame, multiplying himself post-mortem, has several recognized talkas who are contemporaries. On the other hand, there are lamas who are said to be talkas of several entities. Before dismissing the subject, it may be interesting to remind ourselves that the followers of the Dasti sect, in early Christianity, looked upon Jesus Christ as being a talku. They maintained that Jesus who had been crucified was not a natural being, but a phantom created to play that part by a spiritual entity. Contrary to the opinion prevailing in the southern schools of Buddhism, Lamaists believe that a certain time of undetermined length elapses between the death and the rebirth of a being on the earth. In the interval, the main consciousness, that which causes the rebirth, is wandering in the labyrinth of the Bardo. About Bardo, see Tibetan the Lamas on page 4, seeking its way. As a rule, it is about 2 years. 100. There are, however, no fixed customs regarding that matter. Circumstances decide the turn given to the procedure. 100. After the death of a Lama talku, that the treasurer, the head steward or other clerical officials of his household, begin to look for his reincarnation. By that time the child who is that supposed reincarnation is usually 1 or 2 years old. There are cases when the reincarnation is delayed, but these are very exceptional. If the late Lama left directions regarding his rebirth, his monks pursue their researches accordingly. If such directions are lacking, they resort to a Lama Talku astrologer. 101. Called Tsispa, a calculator. It is the Tsispa who draws horoscopes, discloses hidden things, etc. Any ordinary monk may act as Tsispa, but the discovery of a Talku is always entrusted to another Talku. 101. Who points out generally in veiled and obscure sentences the country where investigations must be made and various signs by which the child may be known. When the talku to be discovered is of a high rank, one of the state oracles may be consulted, and this is always done for the reincarnations of the Dalai Lama and the Tashi Lama. Sometimes a young boy is quickly found whose birthplace and other characteristics answer the directions given by the late Lama or the astrologer. In other cases, years elapse without finding anyone, and some incarnations even remain undiscovered. This is a cause of deep sorrow to the devotees of the Tulku, and still more to the monks of his monastery, which, lacking its worshipful head, does not attract the same number of pious benefactors, suppliers of feasts and gifts. Yet, while some lament that sad plight may be a cause of secret joy to a cunning steward who, during the absence of a legitimate master, manages the business of the Tulku estate on his own authority and may thus find a way to make his own fortune. When a child is discovered who nearly answers the prescribed conditions, a Lama clairvoyant is again consulted, and if he pronounces in favor of the child, the following final test is applied. It sometimes happens when several children are candidates to a vacant Tulku seat, that equally convincing signs have been noticed concerning each of them, and they all correctly pick out the objects owned by the defunct Lama. Or it sometimes occurs that two or three clairvoyants disagree among themselves as to which is the authentic Tulku. Such cases are rather frequent when it is a question of succeeding to one of these grand Tulkus, lords of big monasteries and large estates. Then many families are eager to place one of their sons on the throne of the departed grandee, which brings with it consideration and material profit. Generally the parents of the Tulku are allowed to live in the monastery till the child can dispense with his mother's nursing and care. Then a comfortable lodging is provided for them on the monastery land, but outside the Gompa's enclosure, and they are plentifully supplied with all they need. If the monastery has no special mansion reserved for the parents of its grand Tulks, the latter are well provided for at their own home. Beside a grand Lama Tulku, who is the lord of the monastery, the Gompas often include several other Tulkus amongst their members. In the largest of these monastic cities, their number may amount to a few hundreds. Some of them rank high in the Lamaist ecclesiastic aristocracy and, in addition to their seat in their parent monastery, they own mansions in other Gompas and estates in Tibet or Mongolia. In fact, to be the near relative of even the least of them is a connection profitable enough to rouse covetousness in the heart of any Tibetan. So countless intrigues are woven around the succession to a Tulku, and, amidst the warlike folk of Khamor of the northern borderland, bloody feuds spring from such passionate competitions. Countless tales are told throughout Tibet about extraordinary proofs of memory from previous lives and wonders worked by young Tulkus to testify their identity. We find in them the habitual Tibetan mixture of superstition, cunning, comedy, and disconcerting events. I could relate dozens of them, but I prefer to confine myself to the relation of facts connected with people whom I have personally known. Next, the mansion of the Pejyal Lama, in which I lived at Kumbum, was the dwelling of a minor Tulku called Agni Tsang. 103. Not to be mistaken for Agyat Tsang, the grand Tulku already mentioned. 103. 7 years had elapsed since the death of the last master of the place and none had been able to discover the child in whom he had reincarnated. I do not think that the steward of the Lama's household felt greatly afflicted by that circumstance. He managed the estate and seemed rather prosperous. Now it happened that in the course of a trading tour, he felt tired and thirsty and entered a farm to rest and drink. While the housewife made tea, he drew a jade snuff box from his pocket and was about to take a pinch of snuff when a little boy who had been playing in a corner of the room stopped him and, putting his small hand on the box, asked reproachfully, "Why do you use my snuff box?" The steward was thunderstruck. Truly, the precious snuff box was not his, but belonged to the departed Agni Tsang. And though he had not perhaps exactly intended to steal it, yet he had taken possession of it. He remained there trembling while the boy looked at him as his face suddenly became grave and stern with no longer anything childish about it. "Give it back to me at once, it is mine," he said again. Stung with remorse, and at the same time terrified and bewildered, the superstitious monk could only fall on his knees and prostrate himself before his reincarnated master. A few days later, I saw the boy coming in state to his mansion. He wore a yellow brocade robe. As he had not yet been admitted into the religious order, he was not yet allowed to wear the ecclesiastic robes, and rode a beautiful black pony, the nearpa holding the bridle. When the procession entered the house, the boy remarked, "Why do we turn to the left to reach the second courtyard?"